another podcast provided by the CPA Technology Advisor at the intersection of technology and public accounting.
From the intersection of technology and public accounting,
it's technology advice and insight you can trust.
This is Tech2Go.
Tech2Go is the CPA Technology Advisor's monthly podcast program, a fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Greg LaFollette and regular columnist Brent Goodfellow, Dave McClure, and Randy Johnston. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession. Tech2Go is sponsored by ADP.
Hello, Greg LaFollette, executive editor of the CPA Technology Advisor. Today we're recording episode 15 of Tech2Go, the granddaddy of the podcast series Intersection Live of our magazine. We've been out there for a little over a year now. We're doing episode 15 on a monthly basis. A big thanks to our friends out in New Jersey, the ADP guys. They've been very kind to sponsor us and pay our bandwidth bills and keep us going, and we appreciate their foresight. We may talk about them a little bit later in the show. We have the whole gang here, and we'll get to introductions in just a second, but a couple of reminders before we get too far. I want to remind everyone that we do take copious show notes, so any websites, product names, telephone numbers, anything like that we happen to mention, you don't have to scramble for a pen or anything. Just pop over to the magazine website. That's cpatechadvisor.com or cpata.com is what I use. It's cheap and easy. cpata.com, and click on Intersection Live. You'll see all of the different podcasts that we do, and Tech2Go is right there front and center. Choose the episode that you're looking at, and you'll see all the show notes, all hyperlinked, all laid out, nice and easy for you, so you'll be able to see exactly what we said and what was going on. We are recording live today on TalkShoe. We do have a couple of guests here, and we oftentimes have people drop in a little bit. And if you have some questions from time to time, why, raise your electronic hand, and we may bring you in if we have time. Finally, if you want to call and leave us a message of congratulations or complaint or condolence or whatever that might be, please do so. The number is 800-456-0864. And our extension is 2106. That's the extension for Intersection Live. Just call and ask us a question or make a comment. And that's a good way for us to stay in touch with you. And especially during busy season, we don't get to talk to quite as many practitioners. I mean, I office in an accounting firm, and as does Brent. So I see him there many times. I spend a lot of my time out of the office this time of the year with vendors and things, and so it's always great to get that feedback from practitioners, to know exactly what's going on out there, and when you let us know, we can be a little bit more well informed, and we certainly like to do that. So let me move on to introductions. We'll kind of move across the country, kind of like the sun does. And so I'm going to start out in the Eastern time zone with my buddy from Internet Access Heaven, the man who knows more about network neutrality than most of us will ever want to know, but an interesting guy nonetheless. David McClure, you're back from your consulting gig trying to straighten the Aussies out. How was your trip to Australia?
It was quite nice. The weather, of course, was beautiful over there. It was summertime, so I managed to fit in a couple of afternoons at the beach and some really substantive talks with the new government in Australia. So it's a very worthwhile trip, and I'm madly crazy about Australia anyway, so anytime I get a chance to go there, I do.
Well, I appreciate your coming back. we move across to the center part of the country and welcome part-time Aussie and full-time U.S. guy, Randy Johnson. Randy, you just made a trip down under here a year or so ago, right?
That's exactly correct. So, Dave, I share the admiration on Australia. My mom's full Australian, so I went to visit the family, and we went all over the eastern part and out to the outback for a bit. So we enjoyed ourselves immensely a year ago.
Good on you, mate.
Good on you. Yeah, it's a great trip. My my tour of Australia went from I flew to Rockhampton, which is up on the Tropic of the Tropic of Capricorn, right?
Right.
Is that the southern? Yeah. From there, I flew up there and took about 3 weeks to drive back down to Sydney, and just had a great tour several years ago. So it's a great spot to be. My last regular guest, representing the Pacific time zone, Brent Goodfellow, out in beautiful downtown Beaverton. How's things going for you today, Brent?
Good, and it's actually beautiful downtown Hillsboro. But close enough.
I knew when I said it that I was off of town. Just drive across that big street there, and you'll be in Beaverton. It's all the same, right?
Yeah, well, Beaverton's pretty close, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, listen, I appreciate all of you guys being here. You're all nationally recognized experts. You're all busy, busy guys. You all spend a lot of time trying to help practicing public accountants, primarily in the area of technology, the adoption of technology, and probably more appropriately, the adaption of business rules to take advantage of that technology. I thought what might kind of be a fun thing to do when we kind of for our first topic a little bit is to talk. Have each one of us talk a little bit about some of the things that they're doing right now this week. What are the projects that we're working on when the profession is out there trying to grind out and get those last audits done and the tax returns out the door, and it's in the profession anymore. We have busy season, which lasts all the time, and then we have busier season, which happens in the wintertime. And the guys are, you know, the profession is pretty busy out there, and it's not really downtime for us as whatever we are, consultants or whatever, but it's I kind of call it different time if it's not downtime. Johnson, what are you up to these days?
Well, you know, the last 10 days, in fact, I'm just back home today for the first time in 10 days because it's just been exactly what you're talking about. You know, I guess the first thing on the burner right now is just thinking through and trying to do accurate research on the IRS 7216 regulation, because there are different interpretations of that. And, of course, the comment period expires April 7th. So this whole issue...
Fill our listeners in, Randy.
Well, you know, the basic regulation, loosely said, is that if you have Social Security numbers in documents, that they can't be visible outside the borders.
Yeah, that's a little simple. Outside anything that's going offshore.
Anything going offshore. So the historic regulation, as I understood it, basically said if the people were employees that you were exempt, which obviously exempted a lot of the Big Four and a lot of the CPA firms.
Right.
Using outsourcers, but the change in the regulation basically says that even if they're direct employees, that information can't leave the border. So there's different interpretations of whether the Social Security number has to be redacted or if the information can leave at all. So I'm actually just trying to do a little work on that. Have also, and at the risk of changing or sounding like I'm changing topics, I actually spent last week in Boston at the AIM Paperless Conference, and probably spoke directly to north of 25 different vendors who had hardware and software products in different categories, and then physically have been in the office of at least 7 different publishers with meetings on directions in their products. So the last 10 days has been pretty hectic.
Still have everybody?
Yep, still with you.
Oh, okay. Okay. Dave, go ahead.
This week I actually had the pleasure of keynoting the the conference of the California Communications Association out in Monterey and got back to discover, to my horror, that I was actually a couple of days past deadline for you, Greg, so I had to hammer out my column for the month and get it on to the office into Melody's very capable hands. So
I'm sure she appreciates that.
Yes, she does. Coming up, just more of the same. Working on a couple of position papers on broadband and trying to work through some vendor issues and especially make my choice of a laptop. So I'm very interested in what Randy's going to have to say and Brent as well and you, because I'm in the same fix as our reader who wrote in about it.
We'll talk about that a little bit. So, Dave, tell me a little bit about this organization. You deal with broadband access and network neutrality and things like that. Tell me a little bit about that organization and some of the stuff that you spend your time doing.
Sure. We were formed in 1994. A fellow by the name of Dennis Hayes, if you remember the old Hayes modem, decided that the online industry needed a trade association. I had just left the Software Publishers Association and had also wrapped up my stint as a marketing guy for the old CPAs, if you remember them. I did accounting software marketing for them before they were sold to Best.
Right.
Which later became Sage. So anyway, Dennis asked me to start an association, which I did, and nearly 15 years later, here we are. We handle most of the public policy issues. What we try to do more than anything else is find ways to help the government make good policy, now especially with relation to broadband.
And so you, in some way, you work a lot with the FCC and Kevin Martin and his little war going with the whole cable industry or just with podcasts or what?
Very interesting. Yes, he is seriously at war with the cable industry and also to a large degree with the Congress. But we do a lot of filings with the FCC. I also write a lot of position papers. In fact, last week we released a paper I authored on the deployment of broadband to rural America, which fascinating study, and I'd love to talk to you more about it, because one of the things it says is we don't have a problem with the deployment of broadband, we have a problem with the adoption of broadband, and they're very different issues that demand very different solutions. So when I'm not busy writing for you, I'm busy writing for the Congress and for the FCC mostly.
So back up a little bit. Did I just hear you say that we have broadband available out in the countryside, but the people aren't using it? Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, that's really where the paper came down. It's if you go state by state and look at deployment between wireless, EVDO, and optical wireless, and some of the early WiMAX trials. You've got satellite, you've got DSL, you've got cable, and in state after state, we're reporting really robust deployment. It's not generally recognized because it's happened in the last 2 years, and most of the data that you see out there is 2 years older or more.
Sure.
And what we're finding, though, is that there's a very hardcore of about 25% of the population that doesn't feel that the Internet is relevant to their lives, or they can't afford a computer, or they don't have the computer literacy skills to be able to use it.
Well, you know, that's interesting that it turns out to be that high a number. I just finished a column. I beat you by a little bit, Dave.
Okay.
I just finished a column and I wrote about you remember Jeffrey Moore's book Crossing the Chasm.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about actually went out and swiped a bunch of old literature that talked about the innovators and the early adopters and things. And my take on this, I was actually looking at the adoption of paperless, whatever that means, but basically document management products within the public accounting sector. And I'm gonna curious to hear. Randy and Brent's take on this, but the data that I have, and it's pretty rich within our productivity survey, the data that I have right now shows that we're just at about 50% of the firms in America that have purchased and implemented a document storage or document management product. Sound right to you, Brent? 50%?
Yeah, I think that's probably pretty close. I would guess maybe a little below that, but
And I think it might be a little bit below, but it's fairly close. It's up there somewhere at the top of that bell curve. Randy, does that sound about right to you?
Yeah, I was going to actually have the same type of reaction as Brent. I think that's a little aggressive,
right,
because the responders who say they have paperless, when you start probing what they actually have, actually don't have paperless. They might be creating a PDF or they might be doing an engagement manager, but they actually don't have a document management system.
Exactly. Well, if you remember what all the research that Moore did around this, and they've taken that bell curve. You know, you have somewhere around 3% of the people are innovators. These are the people that stand in line at Best Buy. They'll buy anything that comes out. They're the Uber geeks, like all of us, right? They buy stuff when it doesn't make any sense to buy it. So we've got those innovators. And then you got another somewhere around maybe 15% of people that we call early adopters, and they follow the innovators. And then if a product is good enough, it crosses the chasm, so to speak, and it enters what they call the early majority, and that makes up like about a third. So when you take those three groups together, the innovators, the early adopters, and the early majority, that totals 50%. You're at the top of the bell curve. And so, you know, when I think about whether it's, you know, 40 or 50 or 55 or 45 or whatever it happens to be, we're very close to the top of the bell curve, and the measurements all show that the relationship for every piece of technology, from the television to the steam engine to the microwave to the telephone to the printing press, takes about four times longer to reach 50% than it does for the last 50% to adopt. So the ratio is about 80-20 in terms of the whole thing. So when I look at this and I go, okay, we launched essentially the first paperless quote-unquote products in 1999. It's 2008. We're about halfway done. So it's taken us 8 years. That means that those other 50% are going to come in the next 2 years. So my prediction is there's a huge amount of adoption in the paperless world in the next 2 years. So that's exactly what I happen to have been working on is looking at all of this data, trying to figure out, and working with a bunch of different vendors like you, Randy. I've been in Boston. I just got back from the Bay Area. I was out there for end of last week or the first part of this week, and unfortunately I got stuck out there and spent the weekend in Napa, and then come back. But spending time with all these vendors, trying to to help them figure out what was going to happen. My prediction is that there's an awful lot of firms that are going to jump on this this wagon in the next couple of years. So we'll see if this curve that Jeffrey Moore wrote about back in the 90s, if that stays true.
Well, just kind of along that same line, Greg, I think it was The Economist, possibly the week of February 9th, that actually had a very nice briefing on technology in emerging economies, and they actually covered the adoption of mobile phones and internet and personal computers and CAT scans and radio and telephones and so forth. and they actually had some very interesting ideas around this adoption of technology and where it made sense and where you had leapfrogs and why you would get certain adoption rates and why you wouldn't get others. And a lot of similar discussion points, but some extra numbers to back up that whole line of thinkings in The Economist just relatively recently.
And my guess is, I'm not sure of this, but just a wild thought, Randy, would be that the article in the Economist was probably more well-stated and well-thought-out and much more articulate than mine.
Don't know that that's true, Greg, but I can tell you the numbers were... But the numbers were awfully insightful because as I was thinking about it, they were talking about the global adoption of cell phones. And, of course, we've had multiple discussions as a group here about how that communications technology is not progressing very well right now, but the adoption worldwide is just continuing to go very well, and the Chinese handsets being well advanced in front of some of the things that we're doing right now and so forth.
We should maybe, as just an aside, we ought to talk a little bit maybe later on about Apple's announcement of this SDK and their agreement to go out and support Microsoft Exchange. I mean, I think that's a huge thing. They may just make this thing into a real platform. It'll be interesting to see which of the big guys, whether it's Sage or Intuit or Thomson or CCH or whoever, comes up with some sort of an iPhone client to fit into this thing that accountants might use.
Synchronized exchange is a big deal, and of course, Apple's throwing 100,000 plus. Is it 10 million? 10 million, I guess it is, actually, for developers on that area.
And just the whole
effort of Google with Android and what I think is coming down the pike from different people that I know there. The summer should show a lot more promise than what we have right now. And, I guess thinking of Google and the Android at a leap of a topic here, probably the most significant learning that I received from the AIM paperless conference this year was the idea of simplicity, which certainly the iPhone represents, and the thought process is that it's good to take features out if you can make the products simpler to use. And as I've continued to reflect on that, I realized that the success of a lot of these products revolves around their simplicity.
Sure. So, David, you kind of live in this world. You spend a lot of time over on the cell phone side in addition to the broadband side. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts. Before I launch into that, can I make one quick comment about document management?
Sure.
Because there's something I've written about that I think is really pertinent. As we move to the paperless office, I'm beginning to see a lot more alarms being raised about security, because what the experts are saying is we're moving into a paperless office without perhaps giving enough thought to how we keep the data secure while we're moving it around. And I've actually written about that for the magazine in an upcoming issue, and I'm sure you'll be looking at that shortly.
Right.
As for the iPod, my take is this. First of all, I love it. As soon as the June revision comes out with Outlook synchronization and some sort of high-speed internet, I'll have an iPhone so fast your head will spin. But I'm not sure it's ready. I'm not sure that your IT department is going to give its blessing yet, because as important as Exchange synchronization is, it doesn't cover the organizations that are using Lotus Notes and other solutions. And there are still some issues with it that I think are going to take probably another year or so to sort out before it's really IT department blessed.
But in the practicing public accountant world, the idea of notes is, I mean, there was a while a few years ago that there was some on the horizon. And frankly, I haven't been in a shop in 2 years that was a note shop. Have you, Brent? You see any note shops?
Once in a while, you'll see kind of a holdover, I guess. But it's usually the guys that have this idea that you know they're not going to use a Microsoft product if it's the last thing on earth, you know.
Right.
So it's still out there. I see it once in a while, but for the most part, it's gone, I think.
Yeah. So Brent, what have you been working on here the last week or so?
Well, spent a lot of time around the end of February on the Windows Server 2008 launch. You know, there was
that was just finally last week, right?
It was. There was 24 hours of virtual launch presentations. Started at noon on the 28th and finished at noon on the 29th. And that was kind of fun to be part of that. Also, we've been testing pretty vigorously Vista Service Pack 1. Have found a couple of issues with some accounting products, which, you know, we can talk about here if you want or reserve for another time. Also, we're working on a number of pretty medium to large Outlook, Office 2007 migrations, and there's some interesting deployment tools for Office 2007, which make the process so much easier than it has been in the past.
Right. So don't keep us in the dark on these SP1 problem. I wasn't aware of it. Randy, were you aware of any problems yet?
Yeah, I was.
Okay. Well, let's compare notes. Where are the problems, guys?
Well, probably the most significant problem that I've run across is with the Thomson client bookkeeping solution product. And essentially, if you install Vista Service Pack 1 and open a data file with using that particular product, it corrupts all the data in
Ouch.
That data file.
That's a bad thing.
Yeah, that's a pretty serious one. Thomson Tech Support says that they're not supporting Service Pack 1 yet, although what they told me was they're not supporting it because hasn't been officially released, which is, when they told me that wasn't correct information. It is officially released.
But it's not rolled out to everybody. Tell everybody how you're going to get it.
Yeah, well, it's going to come through Windows Update, just like any of the other service packs. There are some tools where you can disable the automatic installation of that particular service pack, just like there was with Service Pack 2 for XP. But you can also download it, and it's readily available for download at this point and for installation. So I suspect they're going to address that sooner rather than later. Some of the other issues, which weren't as serious, were just some connectivity issues with the accounting products, particularly ProFX, the CCH product, slowed down just a little bit after, which was surprising because one of the specific issues that was addressed with Service Pack 1 was this whole file transfer issue. And if you transferred a file from, say, a Server 2003 machine from a Vista client prior to Service Pack 1, it took quite a while, and it was significantly improved with the installation of Service Pack 1. So we're still trying to determine exactly what those issues are, but the most serious one was the data corruption issue that we ran across.
Sure. Randy, are those the problems you've seen?
Those plus a few more. There are still issues with reboots. In other words, some systems will go into infinite reboots. There are issues with new blue screens of death that are appearing, and there are issues with the product just freezing. So all real low-level lockup type of issues are occurring as well.
None of those things are fun. So is the best thing for practicing accountants if they are running Vista, and I know, in fact, I think both of you guys had said, you know, you might want to wait till after tax season to do that, but if they are running Vista, they got a new machine, they're running Vista, things are going along, should they go in and set their Windows Update to just hold that SP1 until a little bit later? Is that their solution?
Well, I think the most important thing to do is if they look at with the Windows updates that are available, that they take the time to look at all the updates and not just install everything that Microsoft suggests. Service Pack 1 is fairly easily removed if it happens to get installed or if it's already installed and somebody may be experiencing some of these issues. If you can't get to the operating system, Randy mentioned some blue screens and some freezes, that kind of thing. We have not run into any of that, but obviously if you can't get to the operating system, it's going to be pretty tough to uninstall it. But if you have installed it and you run into issues with applications, then it's pretty easily uninstalled. The other thing is, we have this whole idea of using virtual machines for testing, and so you could certainly build a virtual machine with Vista and put the Service Pack 1 on in a virtual environment and test there. And that way, if you end up blowing something up, then you've just ruined an image as opposed to ruining your host system.
Right. Good idea. And we've certainly talked about that before. That should be start to be a normal part of, every conversation to do that that virtual thing. David, are you running any Vista machines?
I do run Vista machines. I have not encountered the problems that they have, but then perhaps I'm not running the same applications at the same depth.
Sure.
What
sure.
I have noticed with Vista recently is they've had a lot of problems with the automatic updating service, and particularly with strange error messages that that take you, first of all, back to the updating service itself and trying multiple times to update before you find it's a corrupted file at some point. Generally doesn't require that much trouble to fix, but it can be very irritating trying to find what the error codes mean and what it fixes. Often the advice given online in the so-called technical forums is dead wrong or just flat not helpful.
Sure.
So it's one of those things where fortunately, Microsoft offers excellent free support to resolve these kinds of problems. And so my recommendation to people is if you're trying to install an update and it's almost installing and then giving you an error message, don't waste time searching for it as you might normally do. Go directly to Microsoft. They can help you best.
Well, I'm glad to see that that none of you guys are sitting around and eating bonbons while the rest of the profession is out trying to service the needs of their clients. I'm glad you're managing to keep busy and out of the bars.
Well, Greg, I want to mention one more thing. I didn't get time. Also, one of our projects, which has been kind of fun, is we actually built a host machine and we installed the Windows Server 2008 with the beta of Hyper-V. And we've got a couple of virtual servers running on that machine, and that's been very enlightening and fun all at the same time. And we can talk more about that if we have time.
Great. When we get to the Server 2008 stuff, I'd like to get a little update on that. I want to move on to our listener question. I had a listener call in, leave a message, and he said, I need to buy a new laptop. What do I do? Now, I say to people often, if you want a simple answer, you have to ask a very complex question. And this is a very simple question, which is going to require a very complex answer. So what I'd like to do is kind of narrow this down. Let's first of all remember that that our listener is the 90% of the practices in America are 10 or under. 85% are actually 5 and under. So the people that look to us that are sitting and listening to us right now are practitioners in very small firms. They don't buy 6 and 8 and 10 and 12 machines at one time. They buy one, maybe two. They don't have an IT department. They don't have somebody to go ask. They do that They run their network and their technology nights and weekends, and they practice public accounting during the day. Those are the cards that were dealt us. So what I want to do is kind of go round the horn here a little bit, and my guess is that that Randy and Brent are going to have lots of ideas here, and I know both David and I are in the market right now to go out and buy another laptop. But let's kind of try and come up with something that's maybe a low cost, and then kind of something for somebody that's really trying to pinch the dollar, and then something for, you know, this is really what you ought to buy, kind of mid range, and then, you know, the budget buster at the other end. You know, what would you do if you ever run into that that mythical accountant that said money is no object? What do you think? What's the buy right now, Randy? What are you talking about?
Well, you know, I guess I must be lucky because I run into a number of the mythical accountants. But I will tell you, Greg, that in this year's material, which we've also been writing over the last 3 to 6 weeks for our presentations this year, we actually will have a section on what to do when economic times are tough.
And Randy, in this case, the hour is your K2 organization. You guys provide CPE to, 50,000 CPAs all over the country for all sorts of different state societies. That's what you're talking about, right?
That's exactly what I'm talking about in that context. So, you know, with that in mind, we figured that this would be a year where there would be some buyers who really need to be very conservative. They don't want to necessarily stop what they're doing, but they are going to be a lot more sensitive to the types of things that they're going to buy. So, you know, with that said, I tend to, in the laptop variety, and that's where we're going to kind of go because of the nature of the question, in the laptop variety, I tend to go to very conservative machines in that area. I tend to go to the big name players. So I'll tend to favor an HP or a Dell or a Lenovo. And, you know, occasionally I'll roll over to a few other players, the Toshibas or the Sonys, just because of special offerings they have in those spaces.
Okay, so
now, if you look, go ahead.
The Sony, the Fujitsu, and the Toshiba, you might see as kind of, they're big names, but they're, I don't want to say they're second tier, but they're certainly not as front and center as the HP, Dell, and Lenovo, right?
That's exactly right. And there's typically going to be some compromises, I guess I'll say, not saying those are necessarily lower quality or any of those type of things, but they will tend to have products that maybe aren't corporate qualified. And, you know, when I look at the type of laptops that I think most of our CPA practitioners need to buy, you've got to come at them with the attitude that they need to be run most of the time. So you have to understand that a home-designed brand or a lower-end brand in many of these vendors are designed to run 2 or 3 hours a day, whereas the corporate designs are typically designed to run 10 to 12 hours per day.
Sure.
So I've been a long-term advocate of buying corporate-class laptops as opposed to personal computer-class laptops. And there's a lot of practitioners through the years that I've run into that have tried to save the money by buying the home brand, and frankly, that's just not a very good value. Now, all of that said, you'll see when you visit the vendors' websites different levels of products in their lines. And generally, again, we're trying to stay away from the home brand, so I'm going up into what I would call the business class or the corporate class type of machines. But the very interesting thing about this particular parameter of, let's do it cheap, but still do it pretty darn well. You know, at this point, most of the big boys, the HPs, the Dells, and so forth, have exceptionally nice machines in the sub $1,000 category. I normally like to have a little bigger screen involved. Typically, you know, 14 or 15 inch is probably the best price performance compromise here.
That's a compromise between price, size, and portability too.
That's right. Exactly right. Now, okay, we can do a little smaller machine, but they tend to be more expensive, and we can do a little larger machine. They also tend to be more expensive and heavier.
Right.
So my simple advice is that in the lines, you're really looking for something that's about a 15-inch size box. Right now, I think some of the best values in the HP line still using Intel chips are like the 6720S, or the 6820S. And those laptops are going to vary in price from about $570 to about $1,000. Now, if we do a comparable type of thing in the Dell line, well, we've got a similar type of approach because, again, you've got what I would consider home machines, and then you'd have what I would consider corporate machines. So in the Dell lines, the home machine is the Vostro. Don't do that. You really are after the Latitude class lines in general. And what you're going to find is a similar type of price point. So I normally would favor like the D530 or the D630 in their line right now to try to get a machine that's about in the same range. And you're going to see comparable prices, about $500 and maybe $20 on some of the leading low price things, up through about $1,029 is about where Dell's range on those two product lines would fall.
Randy, what about that XPS line? That's kind of falls somewhere in between. Is that a business class in your opinion?
Yeah, the XPS is generally a business class line as well. But I think the safe buy that's still, you know, strong in the Dell product is really the Latitude. You know, for the high-end machines, as you'll figure out here in just a little bit, I normally will go up into the high end of the Latitude or the Precision line in Dell's family, and I'll normally roll over to the workstation class portables in the HP family. Most practitioners that I've recommended the workstations are just exceptionally pleased with those, and the XPS really is the higher end.
So, Brent, you've kind of listened to the beginnings of a way to look at that. Agree or disagree?
Well, I agree somewhat. I can give you my opinion on this. Obviously, the Tier 1 guys, we have real good luck with their products. And if you look at the if you look at CNET's top five, interestingly enough, this is the CNET editors that are rating these machines. The Dell comes in kind of at the bottom of the stack, and that seems to, based on our experience, that seems to be about where Dell fits. So, you know, in order, this is the way CNET lists them. Lenovo is number one, Gateway number two, Toshiba number three, Apple MacBook, which we didn't talk too much about, number four, and then Dell number five. The other thing I think we have to remember is buying a laptop is a little like buying a car because there are so many options.
Right.
It really, really helps to understand what the end user wants out of their laptop experience. You know, I don't think you can say 15-inch fits all because some users, you know, they travel more or they're more mobile and they want a little smaller footprint.
Yep.
Some power is an issue, some video is an issue,
right.
Some hard disk space, you know, all those things enter into it.
Right.
And
we have to look back and go, okay, this is a practicing public accountant in a small firm, and by and large there is some commonality for those people. You know, they travel some but not extensively. Most of them aren't doing, you know, 100,000 miles a year on an airplane. You know, they're out a little bit, so, you know, they have some data, but not, you know, not an incredible amount of data. You know, there is some, you know, we do have some idea of what this person might look like.
Well, you know, I'm not sure I'm still not sure it's fair to, you know, to kind of stereotype because,
yeah, you're right.
Frankly, I've run into sole practitioners that have a specialized practice in, say, pension audits or something like that, and it's a sole practitioner, but they travel all over the place,
yep.
You know.
good point.
You know, so I think it helps to understand kind of what the end user needs out of a laptop, and then kind of go from there. The last thing I wanted to say about laptops is, you know, there is the custom option, and I'm not sure practitioners are fully aware of this, but Intel has a product line called a VBI laptop, or Verified by Intel. And essentially what they've done is they've taken some common building blocks. So they've taken a chassis and they've taken, you know, hard disks and they've taken optical drives. And these are interchangeable. So, for example, you could buy a chassis from one of the four commonality vendors that Intel supports here, and you could buy an optical drive from yet another vendor, so to speak. The nice thing about those particular machines is Intel provides a 3-year advanced warranty replacement on every component in those in that particular machine, even though they don't manufacture all the components.
Sure.
So that's another option as well.
Right. In order to do that, you got to go find somebody that you know, love, and trust. You know, to do that custom building, right? That's
you have to find somebody that is Intel authorized. And they have a couple of different levels, but, you know, obviously somebody with a track record, somebody that you know and trust, as you suggested.
So I'm curious about one thing. There's a big difference between your list and Randy's list, and the one that I see that's extremely different is that HP is missing from the CNET list. And HP is, if I mean, they bounce back and forth with Dell for the number one seller of machines in the world. How do they not make that list?
Well,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, my opinion is that it has to be in quality and end user experience. And you know, I think Dell's coming back, but for a long time there, Dell was not as quality conscious as they had been in the past, and HP's had some quality related problems as well, in my opinion.
Sure.
Yeah, and you know, on that one, I think my experience is it's advertising spend, and even in the review process, it seems to make an awful lot of difference. You know, in the CNET world, in particular. I think there's an awful lot of correlation between spend and exposure.
Yeah, you're probably right. So with the exception of the Mac Air, and what's the Lenovo product that's kind of the Mac Air competitor?
You're asking about is the X family. I'll double check that here as we continue to talk.
Yeah. I think that's right, but there's Lenovo's got a product that's you know pretty much like that. You know, Steve Jobs wouldn't like me saying that, I'm sure, but it's kind of like that Mac Air. Those are pretty slick. You know, extremely light, and you're paying a lot of money for some early sex appeal. So both of you think for somewhere around this $1,000. We ought to be able to send McClure out to buy something that's okay. If we tell him he's got to open his wallet bigger, where should he spend the money? Is this first spend the money in RAM or processor or what?
All those things.
Oh, yeah, unfortunately, it becomes a lot more of all those things. And by the way, it was the X61 is what you were asking about.
Right.
But, you know, when you start thinking about that, again, we're all in this realm of what it's going to take to play on Vista. And as we've had in our prior conversations, I'm much more aggressive about the amount of RAM, which forces us into 64-bit, 4-gig, and so forth. But for this buyer who's just mainstream, 2-gig is probably enough to get by. But more processor, more RAM, faster hard drives all have real direct benefit. But remember, the number one benefit under Vista is video RAM, which is still not very well documented or supplied in a lot of these laptop models.
Right. That's usually the spot where you go in and look at that Vista what do you call that, experience rating, Brent?
Yes.
That's usually the spot where that gets slowed down is in the video, isn't it?
Yeah, and the graphics for sure. I think, Randy, it's the X300, the Lenovo Mac Air compatible. The X300 is the Lenovo.
300 is the lightest, that's right.
Yeah, and that's like, I want to say, retail, that's in the $2,800 range, something like that.
Yeah.
And you can buy a heck of a Lenovo laptop for, you know, $800 less than that, something with 4 gigs of RAM and 64-bit capable. So if you pay extra for that ultra portability.
Sure.
Yeah, in fact, when you look at those ultra portables like the X300 and that family, that really thin Mac Air competitor, generally, once you get to these, we'll just call them leading edge technology boxes, they're going to be $2,500 to $3,500 routinely. You know, the Mac Air or the Mac Pro families, in fact, personally just purchased a Mac Pro for a particular employee. It was a $3,700 box. And, you know, as I kind of scratched my head on that, I knew it was right for that particular person, but it was clearly double a very functional, mainstream computer from any of the top 5, 6, 7 players we're talking about. And, you just kind of say, well, is this really needed for this person and their situation? The conclusion was, yes, that's why we bought it. But really reflected on purchasing a Mac Air, which would have been similar dollars versus the full boat Mac Pro. And by the time you add the pieces that you might carry with you, like the DVD drive and so forth, the weight and size was so much the same that the Mac Air just didn't make sense for this particular application for us.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because, you know, if you get these little light machines, like even some of the ultra mobile PCs, as Randy said, by the time you carry an optical drive and a keyboard and all these other things that make it work like a laptop, you're kind of in the same weight range.
And that's what took me from the 12-inch ultra lights, which I really enjoyed carrying, but I found that I was carrying all the extra stuff to keep me functional on the road. And by the time I put everything on the scale and looked at the capacity and size, I said, gee, a compromise in the middle on a 15-inch laptop is a lot better for me, because the weight is almost exactly the same, and I've got a lot more functionality without lots of different parts running around. And that's exactly where we landed on the Mac, because by the time we put the functionality in the Mac that we needed, well, the total weight in the Mac Pro was actually about the same as the Mac Air. It was like 2 ounces off.
Guys, we need to move ahead. I think we've given our listener an awful lot to chew on, and some very specific things and some very conceptual things. So great answers, and I appreciate your help there. Before we move on to our next couple of topics, I wanna talk for just a minute about something that the guys over at ADP have launched, a product called Run, and this is a special payroll for accountants. It's basically a new payroll service offering targeted directly to practicing public accountants who service multiple companies. So all of the people who are out there, looking at doing payroll and are looking at thinking about something that's entirely web-based, full payroll capability, all the paycheck calcs and all of that process on-site. You can print the checks, or you can do the direct deposits. And the neat thing about this is it's all been designed specifically for practicing accountants, but kind of based on this, the long-term knowledge of payroll that ADP has built over the years. And I'm pretty impressed with this. I've looked at it some, and I think they hit it this time. They got religion. They understand now what practicing accountants really need, and they've got enough different products out there that it makes sense. You know, they've got the referral product, they got the acquisition product, they got the wholesale product, so they pretty well got things covered. So I would encourage you, you're practicing public accounting, you've got clients that are interested in having some help with their payroll and looking to you. There's lots of different solutions for you over at ADP, and I would encourage you to add them to the list of vendors you're going to look at. You may well find your answer there.
And Greg, I had no idea you were going to talk about this today, but I was actually reviewing this with ADP yesterday.
Okay.
So it is rather interesting from a timing perspective, but we really did focus on this concept of the CPA firm and the competitors that we know that are in this space and how serious ADP is about the RUN offering and about the CPA referral piece. They actually have a dedicated team. The group I was talking to was in Allentown that's really behind a lot of the CPA firm relationships. And I think my favorite quote from the conversation might be, our goal is not really so much to try to sell, but to really kind of tell the CPA firms where we're at, what we're doing, and why, and to support them in their practice. And I hadn't heard phraseology like that for a while, but they were very much committed to the CPA firm's clients in their thinking.
Yep, they're kind of coming around. I'm not sure I understand exactly the naming of this product name, but I have heard lots of longtime accountants, you know, people my age, that when you say, let's talk about payroll, they say, RUN! But I don't think that's what it was named for. But they're certainly, these guys at ADP are certainly doing a great job, and I want to thank them for their sponsorship and encourage everybody to go give them a shot. Listen, we've got just a little bit left, and I'm gonna take Brent completely out of the mix this month, and much to his chagrin, I'm sure, because we're not gonna have time to do the Microsoft Server topics as we should, because it's big stuff. So we're gonna record another edition very, very soon, and we'll start our next edition. Episode 16 next month, Brent, with Microsoft Server, and I'd like to talk a fair amount about this whole launch thing and some of the different things that happened. Can you live with that?
Perfectly happy with that.
All right, super.
Yeah, and that will actually give us a Brent a chance to absorb the Kodaro acquisition for the desktop virtualization by Microsoft today.
Ooh, didn't know about that one.
Yep.
Oh, no one.
Yeah, that's a pretty important piece, because this desktop virtualization is really what Xen and VMware and other competitors had that Microsoft was getting close but didn't have a key piece. And now they've bought that piece.
David, I want to take our last 5 or 7 minutes here and talk a little bit about PowerPoint. Now, Randy, you do lots of presentations, and I do lots of presentations. I seem like I live in PowerPoint. But when you practice public accounting, a lot of people don't live in PowerPoint. They live in Excel and a little bit in Word, and then they have to go over to PowerPoint. And there are times when they really need this, to go out and present stuff to clients. It certainly makes you look a lot more prepared and organized. So, Dave, talk to me a little bit about some of the hints that you've got when you go out to do a presentation, or you jump on an airplane and fly to Sydney to do a presentation. What do you take along with you? How do you do that, and why would an accountant care?
Well, I think the starting point is to become familiar with PowerPoint, because I think you're absolutely right. I think a lot of accountants are very familiar with the Word and Excel environments, but really haven't delved much into PowerPoint, and that's a shame, because it is an extremely powerful program where the graphics are easy. It's very easy to mix elements, particularly elements like video, into your presentation. Frankly, when I travel, all I take with me is an SD card with my presentation on it, or something USB-enabled, a little USB keychain storage device, with my presentation on it because that's all I need. If you are traveling internationally, that's probably all you should do. If you're going to your client's place, I can only say that it's a far different world than it was a couple of years ago when I was stumping around making local presentations and had to carry literally a suitcase full of equipment with me. Your remote was wired to the projector. The projector was very large and clunky, if indeed, and you generally had to have a laptop with you. All of that is gone. Now, the new generation of display devices, the projectors, for example, will fit very easily in a corner of your briefcase, and many of them can accept USB devices that allow you to load your PowerPoint presentation directly from there. And by the way, if you find an error in it at the last minute, pop into the business center at your hotel. They generally have, I've never found one yet that didn't have PowerPoint loaded. And I would, again, carry a little clicker, a little remote clicker. They're dirt cheap, easy to use. The technology has just come a long way, Greg, but I'm still a big fan of carrying as little as possible, so I use a projector that has the capability to just simply show.
So when you you travel to Australia, you just take your stuff on an SD card, and away you go, huh?
Yes, sir. That's exactly right. Why carry all the other stuff? Because locally, every hotel, every client place literally has the ability, if they don't own a projector, to get one pretty easily. And if you're really, really stuck and you have to buy one locally when you're traveling, you can afford to do that. They don't break the bank like they used to.
One of the caveats that I would throw in there, Dave, is that unlike some of the other differences between 03 and 07, the PowerPoint differences between 03 and 07 are serious. And
yes.
If you've moved to 07 and you've prepared your presentations in 07 and you open it on an 03 machine, although it will open, the rendering in many, many, many cases, the slide builds and the renderings and things are, it's scary. It's not incompatible, but it's very, very difficult. And I don't find people who, and I've been in 07 for a long, long, long time, I've yet to find a hotel or a business service center, anybody that's using 07. And 90% of the time when I'd walk into a room to do a presentation, the machine that's there is equipped with Office 03.
Yeah, and I meant to say you're absolutely right. Always, if you are going into an unknown environment, always select the option to save it as an 03 presentation.
Right, but there's actually more to it than you can save it that way, but then you got to go find an 03 PowerPoint program and actually look at how it renders in 03. Because even if you've saved it in 03, when you look at it on your machine in 07, it behaves much differently. Is that, Randy, do you have that experience? Have you run into that?
Yes, I have had that. So, for me in the last year, I've done most of the transition to the PowerPoint 2007, but it's common. In fact, it's happened to me in the last 2 weeks that when I'm supplying materials for other people, I often have to back off to 2003. And it is normal when I go from 7 to 3 that I actually have to do a bit of a testing. I've learned to become a little more generous with head spaces and things like that. So I actually have kind of worked myself around those issues. But it is clear that things do not display exactly the way in 7 that they do in 3.
Right. Interesting stuff. Brent, any thoughts on when they're going to get that fixed?
Well, I don't know if they intend to fix it. The file formats are completely different in Office 07, and there comes a point in time where you have to move forward, and I don't think Microsoft sees it as an issue. They of course, they want to try and support backward compatibility, but when you're moving from a proprietary format to an XML-type open format, there's some things you just can't do.
Right. Well, guys, we're rapidly coming to the end of our hour, and I want to thank you all again very much for all you do for the profession, for your time, for sharing your expertise, and We've got a bunch of fun things on the list to talk about when we record episode 16. We'll be doing that very soon because I'm disappearing for the month of April. I'm going to Brazil for the month. So I've asked, you guys have all been kind enough to agree to get an extra one in the can. We'll be doing that next week. And to you guys listening, it'll be seamless. And we'll be back in May with all the shows. And Randy, I'm sure your speaking schedule is wall-to-wall now for next year, right?
It is pretty jammed. In fact, I was having trouble finding a day I could work with somebody in the month of May.
Yep. I certainly know that feeling, and I'm sure I'll run into you a couple of times in that month. I'll probably see you more than I see my wife, which is scary for both of us, I'm sure.
Amen.
All right. Well, Brent, thanks very much. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon in Hillsdale. Say hello to your bride. David, thanks so much for joining us, and welcome back from Down Under. Randy, as usual, thanks very, very much. And we look forward to recording episode 16 soon. This has been Tech to Go, episode 15, Intersection Live, the podcast series of the CPA Technology Advisor. Thank you, everybody, and we'll see you next month. Bye.
That wraps up this edition of Tech to Go. Join the team around the table again next month for more technology advice and insight you can trust. This has been a podcast provided by the CPA Technology Advisor at the intersection of technology and public accounting.